shares, market, the S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, our special and somewhat regular these days mailbag edition for this Sunday. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, on a Sunday of all things, Dr. Ivan Mahati. G'day, Doc. How are you?
Oh, I'll just say all right.
Oh, come on.
I'll just stick with all right.
It's Sunday, mate. The market's closed. You got to be okay.
It's like Thursday here, so I'm just about all right.
We are pre-recording this on a Thursday, as I suggested, on Friday's podcast, because we've got so many great questions from our members, our listeners, and we want to answer some of them. So I figure that's probably worth doing. Should we just get into it, mate?
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, buddy. The first question comes from Siegfried, who says, I have a question. Can you help? He's come to the right place. He says, question for Scott and Doc. I'm a long-time listener and EO subscriber, Extreme Opportunities, which is your service. So if he's unhappy from here, it's your fault. If he's happy, I'm going to collect the credit.
Right. Now, he must be unhappy because a lot of companies are in red.
Okay. It's been a tough little while. He says, it's the first time I've asked a question. Love the podcast. Been listening since 2018. Thank you, mate. And have the confidence to keep buying in this climate of pandemic and economic disaster. My question, should you place your shares in a DRP, a dividend reinvestment plan, during these low times so you get extra shares at a much lower rate? And when the economy recovers, you switch off the DRP and enjoy the dividends? That's a really, really good question, mate. So, there's a timing component, not timing, but you know, when to reinvest the dividends and when to enjoy the dividends. So there's that question. There's also the DRP question, the dividend reinvestment plan. So maybe you can tell us what a DRP is. I know you're not really a dividend guy, but I'll throw the first question to you.
Yeah.
And then talk about whether or not it's appropriate at this particular point in time.
Yeah. So the dividend reinvestment plan, basically the company says, instead of giving you the dividend, I can give you the equivalent number of shares. And sometimes the companies do that explicitly, which basically means that they're not actually sending out cash, but instead printing some shares. Sometimes the broker does it for you, in which case the broker basically just buys the shares in the market using your cash. Either way, it's still a cash payment to you as far as the books are concerned.
Yes.
So that's the dividend reinvestment plan in essence.
So the plan automates the process of buying more company shares with your dividends rather than giving you the cash.
That's right. And you know, it's an interesting way. If you like the company, you like the price, effectively it's like a dollar cost averaging sort of thing. Mm. When the price is high, you get fewer shares. When the price is low, you get more shares. And he's an EO subscriber. There are not many companies on the EO which actually pay a dividend. So this probably doesn't matter. In general, I think it again depends on, you know, if you want to accumulate more shares, it's one of the ways to do it. If you think the company is reasonably fairly valued or undervalued, then this is a reasonable way to, again, add more shares.
Yeah.
If you think it's not trading at the higher end of its valuation, then it's probably not, if you think the shares are a hold and not a buy, then it's probably not the right thing to do with the cash to buy more shares, right? You're basically adding to your position. Mm. So that's the basic consideration I would have. I don't have a economic angle to it. The economic angle comes in terms of how you think about the price of the shares. Mm-hmm. As such, I don't think about the economic aspect of the broader economy. It's more, you know, what I think of the price. Mm. I actually don't do DRP at all. Largely because you'd have to go look and think and, you know, whether to turn it on, turn it off and so on.
Yep.
So I'm not a participant of DRPs. I just take the cash where appropriate. Most of my companies actually don't pay that much dividend anyways. So it's a small amount of cash that comes in and which I just keep in the brokerage account, use that to just buy shares that I like.
Nice, good idea. I think that's the question, Siegfried. So there's two parts, as I said. The timing bit, look, I have been buying shares. I'll continue to buy shares. Other people prefer to wait and see what happens. That either is fine. DRPs are kind of... It's a form of, I'll call it pre-commitment, right? So there's a whole lot of behavioral psychology research done. And, you know, what we want to do is avoid our psychological biases, right? We want to be as clear thinking as we can and make the right decisions that we can at the time they need to be made. And that's really hard to do for a million different reasons. Some of those are our inability to make the right decisions at the right time. But we are able to make those decisions in advance, or at least absent some of those stimulus, like, for example, pessimism around market movements. So what a DRP does is it's a pre-commitment device. It says, when I get the dividend, I'm going to reinvest it rather than spending it or leaving it in cash or not getting around to it or whatever, in a way that also saves you a couple of bucks on brokerage. It's not a huge deal, but it can be. You know, if you're getting 100, 200 bucks worth of dividends and you can reinvest that rather than spending 20 bucks brokerage to reinvest 100 bucks, then that actually does have some meaningful savings, and that can be worthwhile for that reason as well. I say all the time, and I'll say again, because it's one of the things I really want to get in people's heads, is the best advice, and the best advice isn't the most rational, logical, theoretical advice. It's the advice that people are most comfortable with following. For many, many people who aren't just investing nerds like Doc and I, I don't do DRP either, Doc, as you don't. I'd rather take the cash and then decide where I want that cash to go. For many people, though, who are investing, they kind of know the companies they bought. They don't really want to have to think about where the dividends go, worry about the brokerage. They're happy to still kind of let that thing happen, right? So plenty of bank shareholders made a lot of money just by saying they ticked the DRP box in 1985 and it'll let it do its thing. And that's been a fantastically wonderful and successful strategy. Now, could you have invested in better ideas than banks at different times? Absolutely. And so if you're an active investor who really wants to pick the right stocks, then take your cash is a much better idea, because the chance that the company you already own is your single best idea is just really, really low. Even if you own 30 companies, you'll have all 30, there's going to be one you like best, or two or five you like best. Reinvesting in every one of those 30 companies is probably not the best use of the cash, purely theoretically. That being said, if you're not an active investor and you're happy just to let compounding do its thing, I think DRPs can be great for many, many people who, again, like, you're better off doing something than nothing. And if something is DRP automatically, I think that's a great strategy. Doc, any more thoughts on that?
No, I think you summarized it beautifully.
Next question, mate, comes from Jay. Jay, start off the way all questions should start off.
That is
with
good.
Unvarnished praise. So Jay says, hi, fools, capital F-O-O-L-S. Hi, fools. I would just like to say thank you for all that you provide the investing layman on a weekly basis. I really look forward to your entertaining discussions each week. See, Jay, that's what we like to hear. We're very simple people. We have egos the size of... No, we don't really. But, you know, it's always nice to be positive. He says, I'm an EO member for the past 6 to 8 months. And during the past week, I have been sifting through the back catalogue of recommendations to hopefully snag a bargain or two. And would love an opinion. Premium, PPS is the stock code, down over the last year or so without the heavy decline of the previous few weeks, but has reasonable figures of increasing revenues and funds under administration. Is this a market deciding this small company cannot compete with the others in the same sector? Or am I missing something? Their figures from their latest half-yearly reports and investor presentation. Cheers, folks. Jay. So we don't often give away service recommendations on this podcast, mate, but it was a good question from Jay and a good chance to talk about a company that many people mightn't have heard from your scorecard. So Praemium, it's spelled P-R-A-E-M-I-U-M. You know what I really hate? I hate companies that make up words for the companies.
Nah.
It really annoys. I hate tickers, numbers and tickers too. That's a different question. Anyway, Praemium has done that. I don't suggest it makes them a better or worse company. It just irritates me. What do you say to Jay about Praemium? Does it deserve to be so badly beaten up, or is there something that he's missing?
Yeah, so I think that's a brilliant question. So a couple of things. So Praemium is basically an investment platform company, right?
What's that, man?
So basically, you know, they manage investments for funds, superannuation funds and things like that. So, you know, and even for financial advisors, basically, you know, you can go into this platform and through this platform manage funds for others, right?
Okay. So they're doing the plumbing for the funds management industry.
Yeah, so they're doing for the wealth management industry, let's say it broadly.
Yes, yes.
They have operations in, they do a few other things, like they know they provide tax reporting, auditing and so on. So basically all the, as you said, you know, back office stuff that needs to be done if you're a wealth manager.
Right.
Now they have operations in Australia. They have operations in Australia and New Zealand and internationally in some parts, but mostly in the UK.
Mm.
Now, one of the things to remember is that any of these companies are tied to the market in the sense that, you know, number of transactions going through, number of transactions being made, amount of funds under management, you know, when I say fund or assets under management, you know, total amount of assets that are being held, and you get a small percentage of that.
Now, if the share market falls 25%, that means you're going to get 25% less money.
Yeah, exactly, because your assets have been hit, right? So, so therefore, some of the decline definitely makes sense, because if you had $10 billion of assets or $20 billion of assets, now you have got $8 billion of assets from 10, you are down 20%, and therefore your fees are also down. So I think that part is really, but here's the interesting thing. This type of company is typically not the one to go belly up because, unless the fund management industry basically goes to zero, which means the entire ASX basically goes to zero, which I don't think is going to happen.
Right.
These companies are going to be around. So therefore, this plumbing needs to happen. Yes, so I think part of the problem is the growth is going to dissipate or disappear to some extent because it's going to become harder and harder to find more money inflow into platforms. Because again, for growth, you need a growth environment that supports growth, right? You need people to be able to, they need to be able to get more deals. They need to get people who are in traditional platforms to jump to these platforms, and all of these things become difficult in a difficult trade environment, right? So growth is going to be hard. It also means that, the UK business was, getting very close to becoming, or international business becoming very close to becoming profitable. But, again, that's what I talk about scale. They're trying to build that scale up to be profitable. In this environment, it's going to be harder to actually get to that scale, right? So it's going to be a drag on the profit, the company. So I rate this type of company as a much lower risk company in terms of going broke, but it makes the competitive environment is just definitely not suitable. And therefore, the share price has fallen.
Does it come out the other end of this stronger? Is it under threat from competitors?
So I think the interesting thing here is that if you think about the independent platform companies, so basically these are not the banks or insurance company owned platforms. So they're not, there are like basically four major players, right? There's NetWealth, there is Hub24, there's Premium, and there is OneView.
Right.
OneView is actually the leader in the superannuation industry management side. Its shares too have been completely, killed. I think whether or not it's hard to say which one is going to come up stronger. I think the two leaders in this field are Hub24 and NetWealth in what we call the independent platform space.
Okay.
I think these guys are definitely better positioned because they have bigger balance sheets. This is a smaller company. So it's, but I don't think there's a risk here for this company disappearing. I think the prices are good. That's why we have left it as buy.
Okay.
One of the things I'd caution anyone is I wouldn't say that a Premium is of that quality that you basically back up the truck and start loading up on it. What I mean? So in a diversified portfolio, this deserves a smallish allocation, but it is not a company that I would go and add I'll not put 10% of my portfolio into this as an example, right? So I think it will do okay. I think it will come back up when the the situation with the coronavirus and the economy has stabilized. Over time, I would think that the amount of money being managed is going to go up. Over time, the amount of money being managed by these guys is going to go up. At some point, they basically hit their critical scale and they start basically becoming a cash flow machine. I think, basically what the market is saying and what I'm saying is that effectively that point at which it becomes a cash flow machine has been further deferred out, which is what the uncertainty is right now. How long has it been deferred out is the question. So, I think I nibble on it, it's not like the market has got it completely wrong. I think the market is, as you said, accounting for the fact basically that the AUM is down. So AUM being assets under management.
Very good, mate. That's a really thorough answer. Thank you for that. And Jay, hopefully that helps you. I feel like every time we mention a company these days, we should say as part of a diversified portfolio, not because the individual company itself needs, in all instances, that view, but maybe that's kind of, as we said on Friday, maybe that's kind of the key message right now, right? It's like, expect, like we always should, but right now maybe it helps to focus the mind to almost always that. If we don't ever say it, please assume we're adding the words as part of a diversified portfolio at the end of our answer. Mate, next question in a second.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, this one came from Daniel. I quite liked this question as a general one, mate. And you and I have different views on this, so I'm looking forward to the conversation. Daniel says, Scott and Doc, I have analysis paralysis. I have a decent amount of money to invest. It's almost, well, it's high five figures. And was wanting to go 50% VAS, 50% VGS. Now, these are two Vanguard funds. VAS is the Vanguard ASX 300 ETF. VGS is the Vanguard Rest of the World, excluding Australia ETF. So he's basically saying half the money in Australia, half the money in the rest of the developed world. I know you shouldn't time the market, but I don't know if tomorrow will be a good time to invest. And that's the question. Doc, so let's go the – well, let's take them in turn. Maybe – I don't know which one. You can choose. Tell me first about the – or sorry. Tell me in two parts about the allocation between an Australian and a rest of the world ETF. And then separately, tell me whether now is the time to do it or whether he should wait.
Yeah, so I mean, an Australian ETF gives you exposure to the Australian market. The international ETF basically gives you ex-Australia exposure.
So you get the world in two bites.
I think it's an interesting strategy to do it that way. Yeah, how much do you devote in each market is really a personal question because there's a lot of factors here. The factors to consider in my, again, this is my personal opinion. This is what I think is right. It does not necessarily mean it's right for anyone else. And I am no financial advisor or planner in that sense. And I have no idea of what people have and what they're doing. So I'm going to put all of those things. This is basically good work. How I do it. I look at a couple of things. You know, if my job is in this country, if I live in this country, if I have a house in this country.
Most three things are all true.
That if this, all those things are true, then I have significant exposure to life in Australia. I'm already invested in Australia. I'm invested in the Australian society. I want the Australian society to succeed because my success depends on the success of the Australian society to a large extent.
Indeed.
Right? So in a way, I look at all of those as factors when I decide how much I'm going to put. Then I look at international. I say, well, okay, I'm not personally invested directly, but the one way to get directly invested is basically to or indirectly invested is basically via equities, right? And so it's a bit of a hedging strategy, if you call it that, that, you know, if something is not right here, then it might be right somewhere else, and therefore it kind of hedges out. So that's one consideration. It's basically how many eggs do I want to put in one basket is the other way to look at it. The final thing, I guess that's very important consideration for anyone, is the exchange rate, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're buying in Australian dollars and you're buying in Australian dollars and you're selling in Australian dollars, but if you're buying in, say, US dollars, or you're buying a US dollar translated into an Australian dollar, then the exchange rate actually plays a role. And there are other funny dynamics as well involved, because if you're buying international companies or buying an ETF that holds international companies, those companies are then trading in US dollars, right? And a stronger US dollar actually hurts those businesses to some extent. Actually, you know, if they had a weaker US dollar, it would be actually useful. So there's a profit implication too that needs to be considered.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah, so the minor things. My rule of thumb is basically, I think, well, have some Australian exposure. And then after that, my rule of thumb is, you know, and I have some cash. So have some Australian exposure. And then my rule of thumb is really, I want to invest. I don't then anymore consider geography. Geography is not a consideration when I invest. When I want to invest, I basically invest in the best companies I can find. Relative to, and the best is a hard word, but you know what I mean by best is relative to price, relative to opportunity, relative to where things could potentially be. I basically want to own the best in that basket. And if that best happens to be in Australia, that's fine. If the best happens to be in China, that's fine. If the best happens to be in Argentina, that's fine. So the idea is to, you know, for bulk of my portfolio then is to basically find the best, the greatest, because ultimately what I think is the best and the greatest are going to deliver strong outperformance. And then at that scale, And if you have strong outperformance in that scale, then the exchange rates don't matter. And if it's an Australian company, then the exchange rate doesn't matter.
What about for an index, mate? When Daniel's not going to buy individual stocks, he's buying the index. So at some degree, if you're right, the great thing about it being a stock picker is it gives us a chance to beat the market, hopefully even by a decent amount over time. Well, of course, we also run the risk of losing to the market. And that's the risk we take when we pick individual stocks. From an index perspective, you're buying the whole market. How do you think about that particular question? In fact, this is a question I was talking about off air, actually. I didn't even – I think – maybe I mentally had this in the back of my mind. Maybe subliminally I was channeling the question. If you're not going to do that, you've kind of got to then look at the total market, total indexes separately, right? So VGS, the global, is about two-thirds US, one-third the rest of the developed world, UK and Europe in particular. Japan is a large chunk of that. Are you confident enough to – Yeah, how would you think about currency in that context when you're not picking the individual stocks in that index ETF?
Yeah, like in that sense, I actually don't invest in ETFs in that sense. Mm. So, I don't know is the answer. The problem here, I think, is I would expect various indices over time to be kind in the same ballpark, you know, plus minus something.
Yeah.
But I would also think that the plus minus something is, I don't know how the currency of those individual companies and their performance.
It's hard, right?
I think the best will outperform the index by a big margin. Mm.
Best companies, man.
The best companies. Yep. But the index of stuff, which is basically going to have 2,000.
Yeah.
2,000 companies are not the best companies in the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah, totally.
And whereas I want to find the 30, maybe 40 best companies I can find. And when I find 40 best companies, I am pretty damn sure that I'm going to trash the index over a long term. Right. Over the long term, it's going to beat any index. But if you want a safe way... You know, in my mind, that's actually the safest way to find the 50 best companies you can find and just invest in them. Mm-hmm. You know, what can be safer than that? Because if those 50 companies don't survive and you don't make good returns on them, as long as you bought them in good, the other, 1,950 companies on the index are also not going to do well.
Yeah.
Because the best are likely to survive. So, you know what David Gardner, our co-founder, has this, beautiful saying, invest in, buy excellence, add to excellence and sell mediocrity. Right, and I take that really to heart when I invest. Mm. So, I don't know. I mean, index investing to some extent is it goes away from that excellence. Mm. So I actually don't have a good answer for that.
With the exception, I guess. Maybe I'm looking for a silver lining. To some degree, the best companies will become a larger part of the index over time and drive those index returns, right? Finally, when they're really small, that's not the case. But if you were to take, and let me just throw names at you, Actually, I won't throw names at you. If you take the companies that drive the US market or the Australian market are likely to become larger shares of that. The businesses that are, the growth businesses of yesterday are the titans of today and so on. So you get some of that. But as you say, by concentrating on the best ideas, you don't get it. Are you going to give Daniel a straight answer though, or do you want me to pick it up?
Pardon?
Are you going to give Daniel a straight answer on his index idea, or will I grab it?
Well, but I think he has said 50-50. So
let's say,
right?
he's not going to buy stocks.
Yeah.
He's only going to buy indexes. He's going to buy these two in some proportion.
I think the 50-50 does good diversification. I mean, I can if that was the only, like if I was, there was a choice, I'd have to invest in index. Would I cheer up? The 50-50 is fine. I could even go. I'd probably put maybe 30% in Australia. Maybe put 70% overseas. Again, if the problem with that consideration really is I don't know what his other Australian exposure is, right?
Yeah.
So if, for example, I am...
And we can't tell you directly what you should do anyway, but so doctoring just generally.
Yeah, I'm just saying generally. And if I owned a huge piece of land in Australia and that's worth several million dollars, that's an asset.
It changes things, right?
Changes stuff dramatically. On the other hand, if I owned a palace in New York, well, that changes stuff,
right,
So I think you have to consider holistically. I think is a holistic consideration is really important. So I'm not actually answering the question.
Doc's taking a pass. Let me ask you. Actually, I'm going to ask you two quick things. So, would you, if you were Daniel, how would you go about that large sum of money? Would you invest it now? Would you invest it in slow, regular amounts? Would you wait? How would you think about the timing of that investment, particularly where we are in the market?
This is my thing. Mm-hmm. Again, it's my... So the problem with all of these answers is... So actually, I'll actually caveat that. If you are sitting on a lot of cash and you can tolerate a little bit of volatility, because we have already seen a lot of volatility, so I'm saying that you get some more volatility, now's a good time to invest.
Yep. Yep.
Because the market has already dropped, something like 30%. Can it drop more? Sure.
Yeah.
But, on average,
yep.
I think from here on, if you take like a 5, 6, 10-year view, If you can actually take a 10-year view from now, I think you're in a very good spot. So it's a good time to invest.
Particularly, as you said, I think probably on Friday's podcast, that there are chances that some, maybe even a lot of companies go broke over the next 6 to 12 months.
Yeah.
But if you're buying the index and you're buying over a long period of time, you're kind of reducing both those risks to some degree.
So as long, I caveat that by saying, as long as you're willing to take a volatility, ride it, because it's going to be still volatile, it's a great time. So to add money and to buy, and basically you're removing that company risk by buying the ETF. So yeah, I'd absolutely, in most normal times, what I'd say that if you have accumulated X amount of dollars in Y years, then I would invest in, if this is my formula, I would invest that X in no faster than Y over 2.
Right, okay, cool. Yeah.
So, you know, because I mean, I invest regularly, but if I have taken like 5 years to accumulate something, then I would not invest it faster than 2.5. That's just my own personal
rule. That's a really interesting idea.
But
I haven't heard it expressed that way before.
But yeah, if I had, now and you want to do this, I think now's a great time.
Nice. Only because I'm an opinionated so I'm going to give my opinion as well. Daniel, Doc, I've got one more question for you first, because I had thought of this as well. Daniel wants some international, some local. If you're going to do that in some proportion, we can talk about the proportion, you've talked about the proportions, maybe it's 50-50, maybe it's 30-70. Is the Vanguard MSCI World X Australia, which is the name of this ETF, VGS, is that the instrument you would choose to get non-Australian exposure, or is there other options you would go to instead?
Yeah, so I think that's a broad index. I am
super broad, right?
Yeah, super broad. So that's probably not my action, my favorite. That, you know, like there are hundreds of ETFs, so you could look at... So a couple of ones that come to my mind. There is a Moat, a Morningstar Moat ETF that I think is actually very interesting.
The code is very helpfully Moat, M-O-A-T.
Yeah, and it's called Moat, and it has actually, the ticker code is also Moat. And the reason I think it's interesting is what basically Moat means, and this is a Buffett term, is these are companies with, you know, basically strong staying qualities, right? And these are companies that have ballast. These are companies that have got some growth. They're basically high quality companies, and they're basically using a valuation view to buy these companies. It's not going to give you this diversification of, you know, thousands of companies. It's going to be like a smaller list of maybe 60 companies or 50 companies or something like that.
Right.
But I would also think that, you know, that is going to actually outperform the index as such from this point on. So that's one example.
And that's more an active fund that happens to be exchange traded, right? That's not an index fund in any way, shape or form. It's Morningstar's own kind of preferred investments.
Yeah. So Morningstar's model of, Morningstar's valuation. So you have to believe that those guys are doing the right thing and so on. It's got actually good historical results. So that's one example.
What about at an index level? If I said you'd go index, the ones I can think of myself, there's an S&P 500, which is US market. There's a NASDAQ version. There is an Asian sort of tech version. They're probably the big ones on top of the Vanguard rest of world. Are there any of those?
So the NASDAQ 100, for example, it's an active recommendation in EO, which it just sounds strange, but it is. and the Asia tech, which is also called Asia. You know, I think those are great candidates to actually consider. And if you're looking for straight up index investing, I think those two are interesting ones to consider. I think they'll be volatile, perhaps more volatile than, the old world version. But I also think that from this point on, the chance that they outperform just an index, as in like the broad market index, is, when I say broad market, I basically mean the whole market index, is pretty high. So yeah, I mean, those are, I think, my preferred go-to would be, I'm a techie, so my preferred go-to is be tech.
Like it.
Yeah, but and the NASDAQ 100 gives you approximately 100. It's not pure tech because there are non-techs in it as well. And the Asia tech, though, is again, you're getting a smaller exposure. So, you know, I think only about maybe 40, 50 odd companies. It's very similar to the Moat. But yeah, those three would be the ones that I would suggest having a look and having a little bit of a study and seeing what they have and looking at their past performance. This is a time in here, if you've got cash, you've got lots of options actually to look at.
Very nice. Daniel, Doc's on a great job. I'm going to give my two bobs worth. I started to and then had a better question for Doc, so I asked him first. Okay, so I would, you know what? I would be really happy with anyone investing the whole amount now if you have something for volatility and long-term perspective and you're buying a diversified product. So that would be the answer. I don't think I would, though. I don't know I'd necessarily go as far as Doc, so I do like the X over 2 idea. I think that's really smart. I would dollar cost average over the next, say, 6 months. So just because, here's the thing, the way investors, the way humans are wired, if you invest now, the money in the market goes in, you go, bugger, I should have waited. If you don't invest, the market goes up, you go, bugger, I should have done something. If you do it slowly, guess what happens? If you put money to work now, so let's say you've got, I'll pick a number, 100 grand. If you put 10 grand in the market now, the market goes up, you feel better because you've made some money and you've still got 90 grand to invest. If the market goes down, you're kind of a bit grumpy, you've lost money, but you go, great, I can spend the next 90 grand at cheaper prices. That's even better. And so the human mind needs to find, to some degree, solace for pain. And that gives you a bob both ways. So I would probably suggest, if it was me, I think for most people, again, you may be different, Daniel, you might be happy to do it now, and that's great. If not, think about breaking up into chunks over, say, 6 months, just as an arbitrary number, not because I expect anything to happen by the middle of September, just because it lets you take advantage of that kind of human reality of, you wait, you get some upside or downside early and you've got more money to invest later. That gives you a bit of a bob both ways. That's, to my mind, a worthwhile idea. I actually like Doc's 30-70 idea when it comes to international versus Australia, or Australia versus international, to get the order right. I like the idea that you've got a home and a family and possibly a partner at some point, and their family and job, all that stuff is in Australia. I think there's a lot of benefit. And again, the other thing is just straight out remembering that Australia is 2% of the world's markets. I've said this before, but if I said to anybody, if you said to me, look, I'm going to invest in the market, and I said, all you can do, you say, I'm going to invest in the ASX, and I say, okay, cool. But you can only invest in these 40 companies. And I'll just pick them at random. They're 2% of the ASX. They're all you can invest in. You would say to me, why the hell should I be restricted to just 2% of the ASX companies that are not the best necessarily? I'm not choosing them because they're the best. I'm not choosing them because they're, somehow diversified or better or whatever. I'm just literally saying only the companies start with A and B, or only every 50th company you can invest in. You'd rightly say, go and get stuffed. Except if we only invest in Australia, that's all we do. Now, you are not doing that. You're saying 50-50, and that makes sense. I wouldn't say 98-2, obviously, either, for a whole lot of reasons. You've got to think about tax, you've got to think about franking credits, think about currency. So there's reasons not to do exactly that. But a 30-70, I reckon, is probably a really good split if you are comfortable with managing through currency variations and that kind of stuff. So I think 30-70 is great. 50-50 is also great. But something like that, I think, is a really good idea. In terms of what you invest in, I struggle with this one because it kind of comes down to why you're choosing the index funds. If you are literally saying, I want big, diversified, forget about it, I'm doing it specifically because I want to harness the world's market and get the growth of the world market, that's exactly the right thing to do. When you start to think, I'll buy the NASDAQ, or I'll buy the Asian ETF, or I'll buy the S&P, or I'll buy the FTSE, or I'll buy the Nikkei, you start to make active bets. You start to say to yourself, I think this is going to do better than that, and here's why. That's not wrong. It's not bad. But if your starting point is, I want broad diversified indices to invest against, then once you start being active, to Doc's point originally, once you say, well, I think I'll buy the NASDAQ instead because I think they're better, then you might as well go the next step and say, well, which NASDAQ companies? And then you're in that active space. And that, as Doc's already said, can be a wonderful way to invest, a really good idea to do. I feel like to some degree, sometimes we're a bit half pregnant when we choose indices or ETFs that are not broad index ones, but are somehow active in some way, shape, or form. I don't think it's wrong. I just think you need to be very clear about why you're buying an ETF and what you're aiming to achieve. And if it is pure diversification, then I think the combination of the Vanguard Australia and the Vanguard Rest of the World is a perfect combination. So I actually like a lot that suggestion. 50-50 is perfect. 30-70 might be an option. I also, by the way, do like the idea. I own some NASDAQ ETF, for example, right? So I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying I'm an active stock picker, and I've chosen that specifically because I do think that'll outperform. But I am taking active risk for active return that you don't have to take if you buy a broader index. Have I confused everyone yet, Doc?
No, I think that's it.
All right. Question from Anonymous. I have an anonymous question for the amazing pod I've been following for a while now. I assume he means ours.
I think so.
The question is, he says, keep up the fantastic work. However, I have a question and a concern. This is particularly relevant, Doc, because there is some news out on this Thursday we're recording this. He says, with the coronavirus hitting New York City as hard as it is, how likely is the New York Stock Exchange to shut down for a number of days? And what's the carryover effect for the ASX? Now, I read a headline this morning. I haven't read the article, I have to say. I think I might have read the excerpt at the top. They are shutting the New York Stock Exchange trading floor, but not the New York Stock Exchange. And this will be part of the answer to the question. So, Doc, I don't know if you've read the story or not. Have you read the story?
Yeah, I've read the story, yeah.
So they're basically going to shut down the trading floor. They're sending everyone home saying, don't come here and shout and yell and point over everyone else and with a resultant spittle and germs that fly around. Stay home. Just use your computers. We're good at that by now. Fair to say, Doc, there is no trading floor in Australia at all, is there?
I don't think so.
So you don't need a physical trading floor. And whether the New York Stock Exchange shuts down won't be a question of whether or not people can physically attend, but it might be things like the impact on the economy and that kind of stuff. So I will say before I throw it to you, Doc, there is zero chance of New York Stock Exchange shutting down because of the health impacts for the traders of coronavirus. I'm being very specific here because there is always a chance that exchanges, regulators, politicians close markets for a period of time in high amounts of panic or concern. So I'm not for a second saying it can't happen, but it won't happen and specifically hasn't happened because of the health concerns, because they've already addressed that literally this morning or overnight our time as we come into here. Mate, how likely is it the New York Stock Exchange gets shut down and what is the impact on the ASX if it does?
I would rate the possibility of that exchange shutting down as very, very low.
Yep.
They might actually, for some European exchanges have actually now right now made shorting illegal.
Yep.
That may happen. But even that, I think, has right now low probability of it happening.
Now, they did shut the New York Stock Exchange after the 9/11 attacks from memory. Now, that again was 20 years of technology ago, so maybe that's part of the reason. It's only possible they do close the market because of economic or political dislocations from time to time when they worry that politicians and regulators will close markets when they fear that an uninformed or frankly just completely freaked out market will do stupid things, and so they try and do it for our own good. There's a question about whether that's valid, because if you shut the New York Stock Exchange but leave London open, then people will find a way to trade New York futures in London. So most of the time they realize that people will find a way to make the trades they want to make. They might as well have a public, transparent exchange. So it is possible it gets closed, but you reckon very, very unlikely, mate?
Yeah, I think it's unlikely at this point. Again, it's hard to know what exactly is going to happen, but I agree it is unlikely.
And the chance that the ASX gets shut down is probably equally as unlikely.
Yeah, I think it's equally unlikely. I mean, just because the prices are falling doesn't mean that they're going to shut down the exchange. I mean, one of the biggest things, actually, it will create a big fear, right? Because if you shut down the exchange, you're basically taking out liquidity.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, one of the reasons we have the stock market is it's liquid and every day you can buy and sell and you can basically get your money, right?
Yep.
You get less money today if you sell, but I mean, there is liquidity there. So I think that's very important to remember. I think, regulators will remember that. But yeah, there might be, extenuating circumstances in which it can get shut. But, I wouldn't say right now we're at that extenuating circumstances.
Thank you, sir. Very good. I completely agree. I think it's remarkably unlikely. It's probably a bad thing if it happens. Unless, as it can be. If they do, I'm not worried if they do it, quite frankly. That's the other thing. If they shut the markets, don't freak out. Like it'll reopen and then we'll get back to business. Almost certainly the market will tank the day they reopen it. I don't think we need to, as investors, worry about it. And if you're trying to day trade the market, well, you maybe have some issues. For the rest of us, Buffett himself talks about the fact that you should invest as if they close the doors for periods of time. Whether you choose that or not is different, but the reality is that it just has no impact on us if they close the market. Next question, mate.
Let's do it.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
This one's from a bloke who calls himself TC, TEASEA. I assume it's the letters TC in short for something. Maybe it's Tony Coughlin or Terry Crown. I don't know. He says, hey, Scott and Doc, podcast question for the mailbag. He says, cheers for the shout out on your page the other day, Scott. Made me feel great about a positive financial decision. I did do that. So TC follows me on Facebook. I'm Scott Phillips Money, if you want to do the same thing. TC made a fantastic financial decision. I gave him a bit of a shout out because he did a good job. So jump online and find out what that was. He's got a question about interest rates, mate. He says, given that we are at 0.5%, now I should say, again, as we record this, a few hours' time, the RBA will make an announcement and almost certainly cut those rates. So this is a question in advance of what it might happen this afternoon. If the RBA goes to zero or to negative interest rates, as the term is, how does this impact our home loan rates? Do the banks continue to cut every time the RBA cuts or increase negative rates? Or do we eventually get to a point where our interest rate just flatlines out till the end of the cycle? Hope this makes sense. And he says, keep up the good work. And I would have sent a copy of this question to Doc, but he's on Facebook and Twitter. Oh, sorry, he's on Facebook and Twitter. Well, I'd rather not use that platform. He says some other more colourful things about Twitter, which I won't repeat because we're not exactly G-rated, but we don't want to go too far. So TC's not going to use Twitter, so you send it to me on Facebook directly. Doc, if the RBA keeps cutting, what happens to home loan rates?
Well, that's an interesting question. I personally don't think our home loan rates are going to go to zero.
Mm-hmm.
Probably be somewhere above zero. because effectively for us to get home loans at 0%, the savers or the depositors effectively have to be getting negative rates. And if the savers are getting negative rate, they'll be putting money in the car, under the mattress or under the chair. You don't want that. That's basically run on the banks. So that, I think, is not going to happen. This is basically going to affect the interbank lending, which means basically it's going to try to push the banks to lend out the money, basically keep the liquidity flowing.
Mm-hmm.
If everybody has cut rates, it absolutely also means that money raised from abroad would be also cheaper to raise, although there's be a currency factor involved in it. Actually, right now, if you can raise $1 billion in USD, you would actually get a lot more in AUD, so that will help. So I think our rates are going down.
Mm.
As I've criticized Governor Lowe before multiple times, I think it was a mistake to cut the rates early on. Now it will come across as a definitely mistake because he doesn't have much firepower left. I think he was trying to solve a problem that was not necessarily a problem at that time. You need to have the firepower for situations like this. We don't have much firepower. So rates are probably going to go to zero. As I've said before, I think they shouldn't have been cut when they were cut because we were worried about consumption. It was okay to live through a little bit of lower consumption, slightly higher unemployment rates, and have the reserve to actually deal in situations like this. I think it's a foregone conclusion that our rates are probably also going to zero, just like everybody else's rates are going to go to zero. And then after that, what happens? I actually don't know.
No, we don't know. And that's the most honest answer we can give. It's worth saying that rates, the official cash rates now are 0.75, 0.5, I can't remember.
Ours is 0.5. Everywhere else, it's almost like zero.
And home loan rates are still 2.8-ish, right? So that margin is, it gives you a sense of, savers are getting paid a few percentage points. Borrowers are being charged for home loans, 2.8, higher for personal loans and credit cards, of course. But the mix of that is where roughly there. So you can see there's a couple of percentage points, 200 basis points, as the boffins like to say, between the two rates. I expect that to remain. If we get to interest rates of minus 2%, frankly, we've got bigger issues. That won't happen. The Reserve Bank will do quantitative easing and other things before it gets to the point of paying those. Well, so should that won't happen, anything can happen. Remarkably unlikely, and so I think that's what we'll see. If rates continue to fall, we should expect mortgage rates to continue to fall. I'm going to say unpopularly here, I said that also on, I was on Nine News last night, with Peter Overton, bit of a plug for myself. I don't know why. You can't watch it now anyway. He has said banks will pass on the cuts. I kind of hope they don't in full to some degree. The reason I say that is because we got through the GFC in part because we have a really, really strong banking system that they didn't have elsewhere because our banks were pretty vanilla. They just did the basic stuff. They weren't super leveraged. They weren't, we had a very strong system. And I think to some degree, as we've learned from the response or lack of to the coronavirus, having a strong system, an anti-fragile system, to use the term that I don't love because it's a bit cliched these days, but having a bit of extra strength, a little bit less efficiency in the banks, a little bit more profit, while as borrowers and depositors we'd like more of that money, please. I think we have to be careful what we wish for, right? Because the more efficient, the more streamlined, the more fragile therefore a bank is, the more economic risk there actually might be. So I gotta say, I hope they'll pass on some. To the extent they need to, I hope they keep some, and I hope the politicians lay off them a little bit if that's required. Again, I don't want to. I'm not a bank shareholder, so I have no dog in that fight. But I would take any day a 0.1-0.15% higher mortgage rate if I had a very strong belief that in doing so, that meant the banks were stronger and our economy was under less structural risk than otherwise might be the case.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that.
Question from Matt, mate, on Twitter. Came through just before we started recording, Matt, so you snuck in under the wire. Question for your always informative pod. Does the falling AUD impact index-based ETFs with a high US exposure, for example, the NASDAQ 100 ETF, as much as it does for individual stocks? I understand a lower dollar means less bang for your buck on buying US stocks, but not sure about ETFs. Doc, What happens when the dollar moves and you own an ETF versus a regular stock?
That's a great question. I love it because I was looking at that this morning. So while the markets are falling, the NASDAQ 100 ETF actually this morning was up 7% on the ASX, right? Why? Because the Australian dollar is falling relative to the US dollar. So, and partly also because it looks at the, you know, people look at the future. So I think the part of the problem with our, with the NASDAQ trading here is it looks at the future. The futures are up there and the dollars have fallen. The combination of two actually gives you a kick. And I love this because, you know, in another service that we run, Motley Fool Pro, we actually hold a bunch of ETFs. And people I know don't love buying ETFs, but one of the things I have been saying for a long time is you want to have ETFs that give you inverse exposure in some sense, because it actually can be a hedge in this sort of environment. If you actually own the NASDAQ ETF, it actually gives you a bit of a hedge against your Australian stocks that might actually be falling, because you know, you at least get the benefit of that US dollar. Now, you don't notice that when you own the US stocks directly, but if you think in terms of Australian dollars, and if your account actually shows that you're in Australian dollars, you actually will be feeling a little bit better, because you're Australian, in terms of Australian dollars, you're actually not that worse off. So it's a funny thing. So, I mean, there's absolute merit to, there's merit to holding international stuff for exactly that reason. Gives you a little bit of a diversification, gives you a little bit of a you play, and also, you know, if you hold stocks in companies that actually operate mostly overseas, they could be listed on the ASX, but operate mostly overseas, or get majority of their earnings from overseas, or get a significant portion of their earnings from overseas, those two benefit. So yeah, it's a great question. I think, again, I'm a big proponent of international investing, huge proponent. I think, you know, if people don't do it, they're missing out for a whole bunch of reasons, starting from all the way, like, you know, from hedging to, you know, hedging just not just your own risk, but your own, like, you know, even from a portfolio basis, actually on these days like this, it would make you feel slightly better. You have something that is green and big green, whereas a lot of, you know, other growth stocks might be actually down. So, great question. And that's all I have to really say about it.
Yeah, I think that's right. So I'll add a couple of thoughts. If I'm reading his question right, it was basically the question of the exposure of NASDAQ versus the individual US stocks. Generally speaking, the currency should impact them both the same, because they're both priced in US dollars as the underlying instrument. So as Doc said, because the NASDAQ trades partly on futures, partly on actuals, it will move in a different time frame, a different way to it. So once the US market is closed, for example, you don't have necessarily futures on... Well, the stocks aren't trading, right? So you're trading the NASDAQ 100 ETF in Australian business hours while the US markets are closed. So you can't trade. I'll pick a company name. Doc, I won't ask you to talk about these companies because I'm not sure whether you're going to buy or sell them. I haven't asked you, so I won't ask you to do it. If you bought Apple, for example, yesterday or overnight, it's not trading right now in the US. And it's not trading here. So the changes to the dollar won't matter. The changes to the futures of Apple, I don't know if Apple's futures trade out of ours, don't matter. But certainly the NASDAQ ETF futures are trading, and so that does matter. So you do get some timing differences. Over an extended period of time, though, from point A to point B, say a week or a month, if the US dollar goes up by 10%, both in Australian dollars, your impact on owning Apple or owning the NASDAQ ETF will move by the same amount. So that's going to happen. That's going to be the way this works. And conversely, the other way. So yes, it's exactly the same. If you're buying US stock, dollar stock, they're both dominated effectively in US dollars. The NASDAQ ETF is based on the NASDAQ 100 index, which is measured in US dollars. So you do get that impact. You should get that impact over time. So whatever, you know, whatever issues you have or whatever views you want to take on the currency, by all means do it. But just don't take that, you know, don't expect that the ETF and the stocks will trade differently. It just makes logical sense if you think about it. There would be arbitrage opportunity. Otherwise, you could, you know, buy every company on the NASDAQ exchange and then short the ETF, or you do the other way around and make some money. If that was the case, someone else would be arbitraging it already. So no, the asset prices and the currency will have exactly the same impact on both instruments. Any more on that, Doc?
No.
Cool. Question from Tim. Stand by.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Actually, a question from Tim and a question from Reno. I think it's the Twitter handle. And a question from Mr. S, which I'll ask separately. Mr. S is a self-given pseudonym, so we'll go with that. The first question from Tim, though, and Reno, and then we'll answer them together. Hi, Scott and Doc. A question for you on the podcast. Does the current poor exchange rate mitigate any benefit of buying US stocks on sale? Are you buying US stocks currently? If so, which ones? Cheers, Tim. Doc, I won't ask you to answer the second part of that question. The question, Reno. Hi, gents. Just wondering what your thoughts are on investing in the American market at the moment. There are some absolute bargains, but the dollar being at 60 cents is quite unattractive. The bad news, by the way, since that question came through, is the dollar's now at 56 cents, and goodness knows what it'll be by Sunday. So that's happening. I'll ask Mr. S's question in a second because it's kind of related, but it's a little bit different. We'll talk about hedging and stuff, so I'll go back to that. Doc, without talking about stocks,
yeah,
does the exchange rate mitigate any benefit you're seeing in buying those stocks? Are you changing the way you're sending money from your Australian bank account overseas to take advantage of any US bargains you're finding?
It's a great question. So I'm not going to answer any specific stocks, largely because I'm actually looking to buy maybe tomorrow or
there
the
we go.
After.
There we go.
And yeah.
And to be clear, Doc's not trying to keep anything from anybody. Our trading rules mean that he can't buy or sell anything within 2 days either side of mentioning a company. So if he mentions a company now, he's locked out. He's got to air Sunday, so he couldn't buy on Monday and Tuesday night. So he couldn't buy on Wednesday night if he mentions the company now with this Thursday. So very reasonable view. We're not keeping anything from members or listeners. We're just simply it's just the way we have to. We don't have to. We've chosen to, as a company, have a 2-day blackout window either side of mentioning up stock publicly. So Doc's not going to talk about companies.
Yeah, so I'm not talking specific companies, but yeah, I share your view. So there's a large number of companies that are excellent, that are probably, you know, selling way below what you could think is their long-term fair value. Or if, you know, fair value, if you assume, you know, their long-term futures are okay. I mean, it is really hard because I would like the dollar to be, the Australian dollar to be higher, but it is not. So the way I'm looking at it is, I think I'm going to take a hit in terms of my currency. And that's okay as long as I'm willing to look really long term. So, I mean, anything that I buy, I'm actually hardly a seller of stocks unless the thesis goes broke. So I'm looking to buy something and hold it for 15, 20 years. I really don't know what the currency is going to do in 15, 20 years, but let's say, let's say the currency goes back up from, 58, 59 cents to 70 cents. Mm. So, I need to make about, 20%.
So here's the problem, right? From 55 to 70, that's 25 cents. On a basis of 55 cent share price, it's close to 40, 45% upside you're going to make back that amount because it works on the denominator of the 55 cent starting price. And this is where it gets ugly. The lower it falls, the higher the mountain is to climb.
Yeah, so that is definitely an issue. But, if I hold something for 10 years, 15 years, and I make a 5-bagger off it, I lose some on exchange, I'll be okay with it, is the way I look at it. It is a hard one. Again, if it was 60 cents, it would make more sense. 65 cents, it would make more sense. If it was like 70 cents, it makes more sense. But nobody knows what the exchange rate. I think if the exchange rate actually goes back to parity, then you need to make 100% of it, basically, to get back even. So that's the risk, yeah. So, I don't know, my personal strategy right now, and this is not suitable for everyone, is if I find that a big brand or someone, with essential services has been cut down, I think substantially, and then now's a good time to buy, in my opinion. But yeah, I fully acknowledge that if you have some views on how the currency is going to be in 5 years' time or 10 years' time, I think then you would, you may choose not to invest, and which I think would make also sense.
I find this super hard, mate. I've had this conversation multiple times, and I struggle because you have to, depending on your time frame and depending on how you think the dollar will move over time, and we can't know either of those two things in absolute sense. Let's make some really easy numbers, right? Let's say the dollar is 25% below its long run average, and I've got a 5-year horizon. If I think, and it may not, by the way, but if the dollar was to go back to its long term average over that 5-year period, then I'm giving up 25 points of start that I have to make back just to make it even before I then get some investment returns on top of that. In other words, over 5 years, my average return is going to be 5 percentage points per year higher than the equivalent Australian investment. And so that's the kind of the hurdle that we need. Now, I'm not trying to discourage anyone from doing that at all. It's just that when you work through the maths, that's the that's the view. And that, to Tim and Reno, I absolutely understand the question, and that's exactly what I've been reluctant and probably, you know, I've maybe missed some bargains, but you whatever you invest in Australia versus whatever you invest in the US, you simply have to believe the stock you're buying in the US is going to outperform by however the currency changes. And you don't have to necessarily know how that will happen, but as you think about, like with any company, if you're investing in two companies here, company A, company B, you invest in company A because you think it's going to have a better return than company B over time. And that's a you know, it's a zero, not zero sum, but it's, you know, one just has to be better than the other. If I said to you, do the same thing, but you have to only invest in company A if it's going to be 5 percentage points per year better than company B, you may still do it because you think it's got that probability, but that's kind of, to some degree, the sort of approach you need to take. Now, how much undervalued the dollar is, how long it takes to go back, what sort of returns you're getting, it's extra variables, and you can't know the answers to these. So we're not suggesting you can calculate them either way. Just that's the mental framework in my mind. Doc, I don't know if you agree, but that's a mental framework I'd be using to work out how do we, you know, whether or not to send money to the US to invest.
Yeah, I think I largely agree with that. I'll add one point to that, which I think is an important consideration, is you look at two companies, A and B, and let's say both of them you think is 20% undervalued. Then, of course, it makes sense to pick the one which is, when you're not losing to the exchange rate. However, mm-hmm. This is the big however. You have to look at the quality of the companies. So if you get a significantly higher quality company with, you know, with fortress-like balance sheet, with something that everybody needs, with stuff that the world is not going to do without, I'm going to be picking the one that is going to exist, likely to exist with much higher probability than stuff that's not going to exist. Mm. So I think on the ASX, that you will have to consider. Mm. I would demand a higher discount on certain companies. So that's my variable. So I think you have to consider the discount that you're being offered and how you think relative to opportunity. I think that's the consideration. I think there's no perfect answer for this. Mm. It's really hard. But yeah, you could pick any company ABC and then compare with another company ABC. They're 30%, you think they're 30% discounted, but your fair value should also, what you think is your fair value should also account for the quality. Because I think in situations like this, quality does matter. Unless I'll take one, I'll add a caveat here. Unless you're assuming that you're okay to take slightly lower quality, and you're okay to assume that a bunch of them are, some of them are going to actually go broke. But then you have to design your portfolio in that way to think that, some of them are not going to work out, but that's fine because on average I'm going to do okay. So I think, but I think this is where I think a mismatch of strategy can actually hurt what you're going to get in terms of returns. So I think, consider, if investing was easy, then everybody would be making really good returns. It's not easy, which is why, and that's, there's no one. I say there are multiple ways to skin the cat. Mm. So I think I'd said encourage thinking along multiple axes. So think about fair value, think about currency, think about quality, think about durability, think about call options, think about longevity, think about, I call it the snap test, or actually David Gardner calls it the snap test. Which company disappears, nobody cares. Which company disappears, everyone cares. I think, that's sort of the framework. And again, to some extent, every company is dispensable. Mm. Just like no human being is indispensable, everybody is dispensable. Mm. I think that's important. So I think I'd consider that throw that into a framework. And then again, you can, there's no perfect answer to this. So buy the best... best bargain on some formula.
Yes, and that's a good point. And so, we get that anytime we add more variables, to Doc's point, the thing about multiple axes, you are adding, complexity. You could potentially add returns, right? It's not a place we should necessarily avoid, but it's just the reality of that and think about how that works. It's really, really hard, right? I think to Doc's point, when I say a company A versus company B, I'm not just saying pure share price, but the overall assessment of quality, price, value, all the things that go into choosing an investment option and putting them side by side and saying, which one do I want to buy? Effectively, you just need to think about the starting point of an investment overseas is just a simply different level, given you've got a currency change. Now, the currency could fall to 40 cents before it goes back to 75. It may never go back to 75 in our lifetimes. It could go to 30, it could go back to $1.10. Don't forget it was $1.10 not long ago. It's a really, really, really difficult thing to try and work out. I have no easy answers. Doc has no easy answers. The only problem is you just have to you have to have a view or choose not to take a view, but in either way, just understand the potential ramifications of an investment in that way. All right, mate. Let's take the second part of that, or the a slightly different part. We had a question from someone who asked us to call him Mr. S. Very spy, very James Bond. Hi, Doc and Captain. Thanks for your service to newbie investors like me. I had a relatively simple question. What does currency gain mean when share price goes up or down? And how does one hedge against losses in this? Stay safe and ask your listeners to wash their hands. I like that. So, guys, wash your hands. Or as David Gardner said the other day on his podcast, wash your damn hands, which I liked. He doesn't swear. He's very, very clean spoken. So he made an exception to say, wash your damn hands. And I can only echo that, and Doc will as well. So we've talked about currency gain, mate. The reality is that just to kind of underline that in hopefully one sentence, if you buy any asset, including shares that are denominated primarily in overseas currency, UK pounds, euros, US dollars, then converting that back to Australian dollars means you have to convert it back at the prevailing price when you do it. If that price is higher or lower than the price you sent the money across at, you're going to wear the loss or make a gain. How does one hedge against losses in this, Doc? Is it possible? Is it advisable? How would you do it? How do you think about, if you do, hedging when it comes to investing in non-AUD assets?
Oh, that's a tough one. You know, like, you know, so for some tough questions, my solution is I don't know. I actually largely have ignored, although I'm looking at the Australian dollar right now and it's like it's falling like as if it's a stone. The Australian dollar to the USD, according to the Fin, is right now at 56.86 cents. Which means my US holdings right now, I look gold. So, I mean, here's the interesting thing so I actually don't think about it that way. The other way, you could buy hedged instruments, but I find you could buy ETFs that hedge against the dollar. But again, you know, you're basically paying up for the hedging, so you know it's going to show up in your return. The way I think about the currency, to some extent, is the same thing I think about, you know, dollar cost averaging. So basically, I'm buying. Someday I'm going to buy low. Someday I'm going to buy high. And as long as I'm not forced to sell at any particular point in time, I just think about the investment case. So I really don't consider the dollar that much. Although, yes, when if I see the conversion happening, it kind of hurts. But So my thesis really is that it's like, it's dollar cost averaging. Right now, you're going to get bad ones, but there might be a time when you actually get a good outcome as well, right? I mean, unless your hand is forced that you have to liquidate at the wrong time, there might be, it probably doesn't matter. Or maybe you make up for it in the returns, or maybe you don't. I don't, again, have an answer for that.
One thing I did mention when we asked the last question, Doc, or answered the last question, was the longer your time horizon, the less currency needs to matter. Because, as I said, if it's 25% undervalued in theory, you got 5 years, that's 5% a year. If it's 25% undervalued, you got 25 years. That's 1% a year, right? And so, it compounds slightly differently, but just for the sake of the exercise, let's use simple maths. The simple reality there is the longer you have your money overseas, the less you need to worry about it. And I probably should take my own advice, if I'm going to be invested overseas for the next 25 years, I probably need to worry less about the currency than I am, in all honesty, because as long as I can find a better idea. Now, if I can find a better idea here than overseas, by the way, if I like Woolies better than Walmart, then the currency is irrelevant. I wouldn't bother because I'm Doc said this, I think, 2 weeks ago, maybe last week. Invest agnostically for location, right? Like you want to buy the best stocks you can. If that happens to be Woolworths, great. If it happens to be Walmart, great. As long as you're buying at the right price. So when I say stocks, I mean the value included, not just purely businesses. But you know, if the best investment idea is Australian, then buy it. If the best investment idea is US, buy it after you consider the currency. But the longer you own it for, the less that needs to matter. In terms of hedging, I completely agree. You are buying volatility protection. You're buying insurance. That comes with a cost. Doesn't it mean it's a cost not worth paying, but at some level, someone else is making money off you, right? You're kind of paying for that privilege. That being said, I have been looking relatively recently, in like 2 days ago, at a US hedged instrument, which I might buy at low dollar prices, because if I think the dollar will go back to the average over time, I might be prepared to pay for that insurance as part of my investing, because I want the US exposure and I want to hedge off the dollar. And if I can get that, I haven't looked yet at the price. I'll maybe we'll do this next week or the week after, Doc, if I decide that it's worth talking about it, maybe investing, we might talk to our listeners about it. If it makes sense, generally speaking, there's no free lunch, right? If someone's giving you currency protection, then you're paying them for that protection, and they're not going to do it unless either they disagree with you or they want to simply take your money and do something you could do yourself otherwise. So if I'm going to pay them the 25% difference in insurance premiums rather than the 25%, you know, percent value I get in terms of the actual hedging problem or the currency change, then I'm simply just changing who I'm paying, right, which makes no sense at all. So there are some options. I could imagine a scenario where if the insurance was available cheaply enough, I might buy a hedge product when the dollar is lower than I think it should be, and then sell it when it gets back to fair value and then go and hedge from there, simply because it just simply doesn't matter as much anymore. So that's something I might do. There's tax implications and a whole lot of stuff. So I haven't thought that through all the way yet. I haven't looked at the instruments that are available. If we do, we'll let our listeners know, mate. How's that sound? Is that fair?
That sounds fair.
Beautiful. I think we've got time for one more question. Question from Sean. Hey guys, love the show. I'm only invested in one Australian company, Afterpay. I'm new to investing 6 months in. So that being said, I was up 15% in total. Now I'm down 30. Looking forward, do you think Afterpay is a long-term winner? Thanks, guys, and full on. Now, I'm going to have first go at this, Doc, just to set the scene. I'll let you pick it up because you know Afterpay much better than I do. Sean, I'm going to say, mate, I don't love the fact you only have one company, honestly. If you're saying one Australian company because the rest of them are overseas, that's okay. Mate, there is absolutely no excuse for anybody to own only one company. The first company you buy, sure. If you're going to then buy a second one, absolutely. But please, your very experience is telling us that roller coaster you've been on. I get it. If you're up a million percent, you know, then you're telling me I'm an idiot for telling you to buy more stocks. And I'm not saying this because you're down subsequently to that. I'm just saying no one should have one stock. No one should have even 5 or 10 stocks, please. Unless you're only investing in ETFs, please get to 15 companies as quick as you possibly can. One will be a winner. Maybe it's the first one you buy. Maybe it's the third one you buy. Maybe it's 15th one you buy. Some will be a loser. Again, it could be the first, third, or 15th. But please just be diversified because, you know, what worries me, Sean, is A, you lose money because that would suck. B, you lose money and then swear off investing because you just don't want to ever want to have that pain again. And that would suck even more because the long-term returns are worth it. You're better off getting a slightly lower return, but compounding that over a very, very long time, making a heap of money. So that's my lead-in, Doc, my rant of sorts. I love you, Sean. I'm not having a go at you. I'm just saying, please help me help you. Buy some more shares, please. Afterpay.
Yeah, so the interesting thing with Afterpay is basically caught in some ways in a perfect storm, right? So Afterpay as a business basically is lending money to consumers to buy things. It's making money off from retailers by basically paying them in advance, but it's basically borrowing that money from banks. So basically Afterpay borrows the money from the banks, gives it to the retailers, takes a cut from the retailers, and then basically expects people to pay the money in installments, right? And if they pay, and if, right. if they have a late, you know, if they're late to pay it, then basically charges a late fee. So that's how it makes money. Now, for this is a great, it's a great way for you know, people who want to budget and, you know, manage the cash flow to pay for things. But if we are in a world where essentially all non-essential services are shut down, and therefore you can't use Afterpay at a shop because the shop is closed. And maybe you can use Afterpay online, but you know, if unless you know, if shops are shut and if people are not going to their jobs and normal life is disrupted, people are not going to be thinking about buying, you know, discretionary items. So your discretionary sales are going to take a hit. So you know, nobody's going to be wanting to buy that extra jeans or the new sunglasses that you probably don't need.
Yep.
Right. So I think there's a sentiment issue at in play. Then of course there's the other issue that to keep the business rolling, you have to have warehouse loans, or you have to have loans from syndicate of banks that basically is being recycled forward, right? So I think Afterpay has got plenty of cash on its balance sheet to weather through the storm, but this is not a good storm for any company that's exposed to the retail side. Or consumer sentiment, right? It's basically just not a good time for them, and therefore they're going to take a hit. I would be concerned if this continues for a long time, because if it continues, the longer it continues, the more strained, you know, your debt deals are. The higher the likelihood of people not actually fulfilling the obligations of paying back on their debt. So there's a, you know, there's this, yeah. So there's the question of people who have already taken the jeans and have not paid for it, will they pay? There's the question of how many people more, and I'm using jeans as an example, but the question of how many more people are going to wanting to buy that additional item called, you know, let's call it jeans or the slippers.
Yeah,
there's the
right.
question of having the being able to service the debt that Afterpay would have with, you know, warehouse loans that Afterpay would have to have. Then after, you know, that basically means Afterpay has to dip into its cash to run contain. And then there's a final aspect. Afterpay is a growth business which has been adding retailers, adding consumers, uptake. That all basically comes to a grinding kind of halt in an environment where everything is in lockdown. And one of the biggest, say, I think this is a way of marketing, you know, Australia is not yet in lockdown, but the US is.
Right.
And the US and the UK were two big growth markets for Afterpay. So in a way, market's basically reacting to some of the ongoings and is sort of projecting that, you know, we will be in lockdown in Australia. So therefore the market is reacting. Could anybody have seen this? No. If I had seen all of this and I'd have sold all my shares and I'd be sitting on cash and then, you know, as I've said before, Afterpay is a risky investment because of all these factors. And if, you know, and this is like the perfect storm in that sense. On the other side of this fence, if, you know, if and when we get through this, Afterpay should do well. It needs to get to the other side of that fence. And I think that is the consideration that is coming into play right now. So I do think their balance sheet looks okay right now. But, you know, maybe the market is pricing in the fact that they might do a raise to, you know, further bolster their balance sheet. Afterpay's got some very big, solid, you know, VC-style funders backing the company. So, you know, they will take their pound for flesh, but I think, you know, if they believe that the model is going to be successful, which I think the model is going to be successful, I think there is a backstop in some sense. But at what price, I don't know. If I hold Afterpay shares, I'll continue holding. Again, I would say this is not really a back the, it's not yet at the level where I think it's like, you know, back the truck type of moment. So I would not back the truck. I would not sell it. I would not be running to top up on it. Again, largely because, you know, this drama is still playing out. Nobody knows how long it plays out, what goes on. And I'm calling it drama. I don't mean to, you know, make this a flippant sort of observation. It's a drama in the sense that, you know, there's a lot of panic emotion.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, if you think about the absolute death numbers, they're not that large, but there's this whole worldwide economy coming to a standstill. So it's a lot of different things that are playing out. So yeah, that's my current view, like absolute latest view in some sense. Yeah, and then again, I just want to make the point here that this is being recorded for release on Sunday. We are recording on Thursday. So between now and that time, my view might change because, you know, because it's a recommendation in one of our services and we hold some shares. I've always said that, you know, if you own Afterpay, you should not own a lot of it because it's very important to not own a lot of this company. Because, again, it's one of those companies that I think you want to own some but not a lot, because if you own a lot, it can be problematic, especially in scenarios like this.
So just position sizing is important.
Position sizing is really important.
I said that was going to be our last question. I'm going to ask one more.
Yeah.
Because you know why? Because this particular question, I had to be reminded of twice that I'd forgotten to put it on the list of questions to ask. If I don't ask it now, I may well get some hate mail. So here's a quick one. Hi, Scott and Doc. Thanks, guys, for always answering my questions comprehensively and helping us all be better investors. You're welcome. One thing I've always been curious about in the stock market is why companies have any sort of interest in their stock price appreciating. Once stock is bought directly from the company at IPO, I always presume they didn't receive any additional capital from the day-to-day trades of their stock, right? If the daily trading of stocks from shareholder to shareholder garners them nothing, what do they gain from a higher stock price except for a higher valuation? Thanks for your opinions and weekly wisdom on the pod. Full on. That's from Turninator. Thank you, Turninator. Good question. Lots of different possible answers. Let's try and keep it as brief as we can, mate, which you and I struggle with. That's why the podcast got for more than an hour.
I have
so
lots
far.
To say on this, but I'll be brief. Okay. Yes, I'll be brief. Right. So it is completely a myth that the stock price does not matter to the companies because, and I'll say on the ASX.
Some companies.
Well, I'll say on the ASX, a lot of companies basically treat the stock market as a money printing machine. And the reason I say this is because the companies are, a lot of companies, especially growth companies, are doing capital raises.
Right.
When they do capital raises, they basically come back to the market, say, give me more money. There's second, you know, that's basically secondary placement. This is not important for companies that, you know, like it's not important for something like Woolies that have got a, you know, a steady, stable business, but it is absolutely important for most of them. They do acquisitions, they do their growth. They come back, and sometimes they even take money from us and say, yep, we're going to pay back the same money to you in dividends. It happens. It is very so. Therefore, the share price matters, not you know it to the companies.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you know, as I said, the ASX is actually true worldwide for companies, even where there is no direct placement to shareholders, where the placement is made directly to so-called sophisticated investors, the share price again matters.
Yeah.
Right. It is only for those companies that do not need to raise capital and are never going to be using their share price to acquire another company.
Yep.
Does the share price not matter?
So if you're not going to raise capital, use your shares as an acquisition tool, it has no impact on the business. But to the extent you want to go and raise more, I mean, you can raise capital at any share price in theory, but obviously the more money you, the higher your share price, the fewer shares you need to issue to raise the amount of money you want. If you want to raise $10 million, you've got to issue 1 million shares at $10 each or 2 million shares at $5 each. And obviously the more shares you issue, the more diluted your current shareholders are. So you kind of do care, right, about that from that perspective. Is that kind of the point?
Yeah, that's the point. So basically, the higher the share price, less dilutive it is. So I mean, yeah, pretty much every company except the very few that don't ever need to use their share price because they're just, you know, cash generating machines. Those companies basically don't really care about their share price in the interim. In fact, they might take, if they're doing, you know, buybacks and things like that, they might actually love a lower share price because they could just buy back more because that then inflates the earnings per share. So there's a lot of, share price actually matters to companies in various different ways. But you know, it's a common misconception in that sense that the share price actually does not matter because it matters because a lot of companies actually use it as a currency.
Yeah, to the extent you're going to raise capital. Two other reasons why you would care. The first, and this is the behavioral part, the first is straight out ego, right? So there is very few CEOs who get to that position absent ego. Whether you founded a company and you want to show how big and great you are, or whether you took over a company and you want to show how much value you can create, in air quotes, for shareholders, that's real, by the way. I mean, to some degree, yeah, if you're doing your job on behalf of shareholders, you want to maximize value. You want the market to recognize that value. That's all very reasonable, very rational, right? Like if you're running, Scott and Doc's sock company incorporated, and you double your sales and you double your profits, you want the shareholders to value to get value from that by the share price going up by, you know, about double, lots of different things, but you know what I mean. So you know that it does matter. It's a sign that you're doing your job and your job is being done, and you're looking after the interests of shareholders. So at a very fiduciary kind of perspective, you are responsible for increasing the wealth of the shareholders that own your stock. So you should care over time that your success is reflected in your share price. So that's the second. The third, actually, I said to this, the third. So first is the ego. Second is that it's actually genuine value created. The third is career risk. So if you think about who your employers are, if you're a company CEO, who do you work for? Now, you report to the directors. The directors are there on behalf of the shareholders. Ordinarily, that's you and me, and we kind of don't care too much day-to-day where the share price fluctuates as long as they're building long-term value. But you know who does? Fund managers who have 3 and 6 month time horizons. If you're a fund manager and you say, I'm buying shares in Macquarie Bank because I think they're going to be $150 by Christmas and they're $98 by Christmas, you're going to bang on the CEO's door and say, what the hell are you doing? I want a higher share price. I've got a responsibility here. I've told people the share price will be higher, or I've got fund unit holders who invested in me, who want a return. I want you to get the share price up so my fund is worth more. The reality is we all work for somebody, and for a CEO, while they're at the top of the management pile, they are the first port of call for an investor. In fact, some CEOs have said, I've heard up to 2/3 or 3/4 of their time is spent talking to investors who just want to see a higher share price because that's what they want. I think that's, in the short term, a really damaging thing that leads to earnings maintenance and guidance that's stupid and, trying to hit numbers that aren't reasonable because you promised it or because someone wants it. And so the short-term destructive behavior can actually really hurt long-term performance, but that's another reason why they do it. So lots of reasons why they do, very few reasons why they should in a perfect world. If shareholders would leave them the hell alone, and if they didn't need to raise money, as Doc's already said, and if they keep their egos in check, they should be doing is focusing on growing the underlying value of the business. And over time, the stock price will follow. We all believe that. Different time frames, different styles, approaches. But over time, if you create enough value, the share price will follow. That's all they should be focused on. In fact, we do them a disservice every time we ask them to do something else, with the exception of the capital raising, as Doc's rightly pointed out. How'd it go, mate?
I think you went well.
Thank you. That's kind of you to say. Plus, you want to say that because you want to get rid of the podcast. All right, we're done. So before we go, though, don't forget you can join Doc and his colleague, our colleague, Kevin, running Motley Fool Extreme Opportunities. You can join their service by going to fool.com.au/EO podcast. They are looking for high return with a little bit more risk, the sort of companies that Doc talks about a lot, the ones he's expecting to be the winners of tomorrow, or more importantly, of 3 and 5 years' time into the future, the businesses that are really, really great opportunities. Some will do well, some will do not so well. Overall, we expect the EO, I certainly expect the EO scorecard to do fantastically because these are great stock pickers doing a great job finding the winners of tomorrow using some of the successful strategies that our colleagues have used, that Doc has learned from them. He's come up with himself and with Kevin, of course, to find some of the smaller, riskier companies that have really, really big kind of, you know, big opportunities, big runways, big ranges of outcomes. And that's a really good way to invest, and Doc and the team do it really well. So fool.com.au EO podcast. You can get a special offer just for podcast listeners by going to that link. Mate, that's it.
That is it.
We'll go back and enjoy our Sundays. But before we do, I'm going to do my usual spiel because we want you to subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast. Do it through iTunes or do it through your favorite Android podcast app. That way you won't miss an episode. When they land, they'll be uploaded automatically to your software as long as you've ticked the right box. And you can listen to us and you know when it's there, which is exciting because you don't want to miss some of our stuff, do you, Doc? People don't want to miss that. This is the good stuff.
Agreed.
And if you like what we're doing, please give us a rating, leave us a review, tell your friends who couldn't do with a little bit more foolishness in their lives. And of course, don't forget, you can get a dose of that foolishness going to straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/MMM.
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money, our special mailbag edition. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.